This podcast is recorded on the traditional and unceded territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh people.
British Columbia, I've seen your mountains high, seen your pretty rainbows and your blue crystal skies, watched your winding rivers as they flow around the bend. To me, you're not a stranger, you'll always be a friend.
Coming to you from the West Coast, this is Politicoast. Today is July 25th, 2019, and this is episode 148. Politicoast is a BC politics podcast. Tell us what you think of the show by leaving us a review or get at us on social media. Most importantly, help us build the show by throwing us a couple bucks a month at patreon.com/politicoast.
I'm Scott Galundebaum.
And I'm Ian Bushfield. On today's show, we're going to get a sense of how bad things are going to get. And then we have a roundup of just stories on everything we've kind of been following but hasn't had an update in weeks or months.
At least one of these is yours.
Politicoast is in partnership with BC Today, British Columbia's daily newsletter dedicated exclusively to BC politics. Sign up for a free trial to have unique coverage of the BC legislature delivered to your inbox every morning. Listeners to Politicoast, enter the offer code CITIZEN for access to a special rate. For your free two-week trial of the newsletter, go to britishcolumbiatoday.ca.
And a reminder that on August 8th, we'll be holding our 150th episode live recording at Creative Coworkers. Details will be in the show notes where you can find a link to Eventbrite. Alternatively, you can just go to politicoast150.eventbrite.com.
And we're very close to being able to announce guests. Look for those on social media this week, hopefully. And we're also very close to having a beer sponsor, which would be great. But if you are a brewery or know a brewery and want to give us free beer, hit us up. First up, our province is on fire. How about yours? The preliminary strategic climate risk assessment for British Columbia report is out from the government of BC's Climate Action Secretariat, and it's bleak.
It is really, yeah, no other way to say it. So this report looked at a range of risks between now and 2059 to examine kind of, you know, well, what are the risks posed to BC from climate change. Turns out there's a lot of them, and a lot of them are pretty bad. So this report takes a fairly standard risk assessment approach, looks at how likely is something to happen, as well as how catastrophic it will be if it does happen. And they looked at both present conditions, or using 2010 as the present day, and then what the risk would be in the 2050s.
It's all based on a relatively high level of warming, but right now it's kind of the planet only does a little to stop global warming, if anything. This would be 2 degrees of warming by 2050 and 3.7 degrees of warming by 2100. Which it describes as the most problematic climate-related risks that could possibly occur. But each time the IPCC comes out, as I think Seth Klein mentioned in our episode a couple weeks ago, everything's always kind of trending worse. So let's start there. And the report points out, even if these don't happen in the 2050s because we slow global warming down, it'll probably just happen a decade or two later anyway. So based on that assumption of warming, they looked at 15 different scenarios, and reassuringly, there are four that don't involve what is described as a catastrophic risks and hazards happening. So we have a less than one in three chance of not having a lot of problems.
Yeah, so the only risk they looked at that got a rating of low was increased incidence of vector-borne diseases. So, you know, if you're worried about Lyme disease, that's relative to everything else that could go wrong, it is a fairly minor concern for the province. Although it's worth pointing out here that just because at a provincial scale, things are relatively minor, doesn't mean they aren't going to be catastrophic in a much more localized sense.
On the other side of the chart are the things that are very, very bad risks, which are severe wildfire seasons, seasonal water shortages, and heat waves. And the other element is that these won't operate just independently, but there's also going to be a lot of, let's call it, intersectional disasters.
Yeah, so if you have a drought, for example, that both increases the likelihood that you will run out of water and the likelihood that everything will catch on fire. And on the flip side, if you have catastrophic rains and flooding, that increases the risk of landslides.
And when we talk about increased risks, just on wildfires alone, the report suggests we could be seeing 2017-like record-setting wildfire seasons with a probability of 10 to 50% happening every year.
Yeah, so either a 5-year return period or a 2-year return period.
Yeah. Eventually, I think there just won't be much left of BC to burn at that rate, though, which is not a good out for this. So that's terrifying. The heat waves that it points out, that could mean severe heat waves every 3 to 10 years instead of 11 to 50 right now. These are very serious heat waves where you could see over 100 people die, over 1,000 people have serious health impacts.
Yeah, Europe's going through one right now, and it just, they're having record-setting heat all along, I think, the west coast of Europe and into the interior, too. So yeah, that could also happen here with fairly regular frequency.
And then there are several other high risks that aren't in the most severe risk range, and that would be ocean acidification, glacier mass loss, and just long-term water shortages, which is even more reassuring.
At the lower end of the risk assessment, you have stuff such as invasive species, loss of forest resources, severe ravine flooding, and storm surges.
You know, those are all still non-zero risks, so we'll still probably see some. It's just the priority needs to be fighting fires and coping with heat waves and the water shortages.
So they analyzed the consequences by breaking it down into several categories, such as health, social functioning, natural resources, economic vitality, and cost to the government. And each of those are then broken up into smaller segments. So such as under health, you have loss of life. There's psychological impacts and loss of social cohesion. Under social functioning, loss of natural resources, loss of economic productivity. So individual risk can vary a bit, but you can have stuff where, such as loss of economic productivity is very high, and that skews it quite a bit up. So for example, saltwater infiltration, which is something you don't think about that much, but basically as sea levels rise, well, Delta is going to get a lot saltier. Not just from...
Angry people.
not just from higher sea level, but the salt actually will migrate into the groundwater.
Making it undrinkable.
Also hard to farm.
And so you get a lot of spillover economic effects. A lot of the storm surges and floods similarly do that. Unless it's a fast flood, you can usually clear an area safely. But this does talk about there is some risk of, you know, these 500-year floods happening.
Well,
they're not high, but...
They do project that a current 500-year flood will become a 100-year flood by 2050.
So we'll probably see another one in the next 50 to 100 years.
Well, yeah, there's a 50% chance of that.
So overall, as a preliminary report, like I said off the top, very bleak. And it does use some high estimates of climate change, but it's better to be conservative on that. Know what the worst case scenario is. Build for that. Build resiliency for that. Because if we build too many dikes and we build too much capacity to fight fires, it's not too much of a waste of resources. Within reason.
Yeah. You also, when you build dikes, you didn't have the problem that you just shift the flooding to other places. So in theory, you might be able to build too many dikes.
If we make our system too resilient.
Yeah. Yeah. That's probably a better way to phrase it. It's hard to have too resilient a province.
Now, as a preliminary report, it lays out a few next steps. The first it talks about is that they didn't really consult with Indigenous people, bring in Indigenous perspectives, or otherwise reach out like the government has committed to in reconciliation. So they recognize a lapse there, and that will be part of the next phase.
Yeah, I'm not sure so much a lapse as just as the project progresses, that gets incorporated into later steps.
And related to that partially, but also just a broader issue that they're starting to recognize is an impact to cultural resources. And I think this gets into some of the unmeasurable economic impacts of some of these disasters. If sacred lands or if the Vancouver Art Gallery collapse, we lose things that can't be replaced easily. And, you know, taking that into consideration is something they're eager to do. And then the last thing they definitely need to do is look at how resilient we are already. Is our risk mitigation adequate? Which is a good question.
Not.
But we need to know how inadequate. But I think this raises two questions for me. One is, what should we be doing? And the second is just like, seriously, what should we be doing? Because this is overwhelming and terrifying.
Well, this is a fairly good place to start, actually get a good sense of what the problems are. So, you know, good for the government to do that. But yeah, what do we do and how do we adapt? And there's two aspects. There's the, how do we stop climate change? And then there's the, how do we not die from the climate change that will inevitably happen, or, you know, have economic consequences, all the other concerns.
And stopping climate change is, obviously the government of BC is taking some steps, and we've talked on this podcast about how no one's put forward a radical enough plan to actually do enough. And even if BC churned off all of the carbon emissions, greenhouse gas emissions tomorrow, we're still a drop in the global bucket. And apparently climate change doesn't actually care about one jurisdiction. It cares about the whole world. And so it's still going to hit us, especially while the U.S. is ruled by someone who thinks coal can be burned in this day and age, among many other problems. So it becomes about adaptation. And that's something I don't think many parties politically want to talk about.
Yeah, no, they really don't. And it's a little odd because it's the sort of thing that you could see, say, the Conservative Party actually latching on to as, like, we need to build our infrastructure, you know, support our communities, all of that sort of stuff, roll out, you know, new economic action plan signs. Like, there's an argument, even if they don't buy into the, well, we should stop burning fossil fuels, would very much help and we should do, but, you know, even if they don't go that far, there's at least a spot for them to stake out a position on, which you just don't see.
Yeah, I think federally, the NDP and Greens plans did include a little bit of adaptation and resiliency, but it was almost a, like,
afterthought.
Yeah, helping communities deal with climate change. It's like, you realize that's a lot, especially coastal communities, because some of the floods they're talking about here in Metro Vancouver, if they hit the worst, they could be displaced like 30% of the population, I think is what I saw in the report.
Richmond Delta, decent chunk of the area along the Fraser River further up too. Yeah.
So we need to be thinking about these things seriously and strongly. It's just they're not politically sexy. You don't win votes by saying, we're going to build for something that may or may not happen. It probably will. We don't know when. It's something you lose votes if you don't do, and you have a disaster.
Maybe after the disaster and some of the stuff, you know, just the life project cycles take so long. It's not necessarily even going to be the people who should have built it who will be in power when it would be needed.
But it might almost be better then that it's almost an apolitical topic, as then we can have expert reports kind of lay out what needs to be done, and whoever gets into government goes, oh, I guess we should do this or the province will burn. And, you know, say Andrew Wilkinson topples the government in a surprise snap election, I don't see him throwing this report out as ideologically motivated. And
No, I don't think he would at all.
And if the Greens became a majority government in BC, they'd similarly probably care about this. So there's a strength there that no one campaigns on it, but you still worry that no one's taking it seriously enough. That's not a satisfying answer.
No, but this is one of those topics where you don't get a lot of satisfying answers.
So we'll look forward, I guess, to the Climate Action Secretariat, which is the BC branch of the government that commissioned this report, releasing subsequent follow-ups on how fucked we are and what we should do about it.
Moving on to quit takes. Outgoing MP Murray Rankin, a New Democrat, has been appointed to the chair of the National Security Intelligence Review Agency. So this is a new agency that's being brought in to replace the Security Intelligence Review Committee. And it's going to serve a complementary function to the organization of MPs that do the same thing.
Yeah, this was one of the promises Trudeau made to, rather than repeal the anti-terrorism bill C-51, but to amend and improve it. He would create a couple oversight bodies for all our spy agencies to make sure they're not spying too much and trampling civil liberties.
Spying in the right places is probably the best way to think about it.
Spy better. Civil libertarian groups have been skeptical because some of the other changes that needed to happen to C-51 haven't, but Murray Rankin has been probably one of the sharpest critics of the overreach by some of these agencies and knows his shit. So seeing him appointed is
just a very much really not good. A partisan move too, because liberal government appointing a new Democrat.
One of the other appointments to this agency was Craig Forsese, who's the University of Ottawa professor who's spoken out a lot on these issues and also been similarly critical of some of the overreach by C-51. And so that's really positive. The rest of the agency sounds like it'll be the appointments from the existing CERC. So promising moves.
Yeah. And this organization's going to have access to basically everything the government does, with the exception of cabinet documents. So, you know, if CSIS is overreaching, they'll be on top of it. If the government is trying to rig a Navy ship contract, a little less so.
In other federal government HR news, I guess, in terms of who's moving around where, Gerald Butts is back. Gerald Butts, longtime listeners will recall.
Did he ever really leave?
That's exactly what this story is. Butts, for longtime listeners will remember, resigned as Justin Trudeau's principal secretary in the height of the SNC-Lavalin, Jody Wilson-Raybould brouhaha in the spring. And he resigned saying he did nothing wrong, but he needed to take some of the heat off the government, and that didn't help anything.
No, because he had this really weird resignation letter, as you alluded to, that was like, I'm completely innocent. I'm resigning, but I'm completely innocent of everything that would cause me to resign.
And it turns out he's since, I don't know how long, but potentially the entire time, been unofficially an advisor to the Liberal Party, and now...
Well, advising on a volunteer basis is what's being described.
And now it's come out, and it's suggested he may get a role out of it. He may get paid from the Liberal Party.
Yeah, as a campaign staffer, probably, for that campaign, which everyone pretty much thought was going to happen anyway. At the time, that was the speculation, that Butts would basically transition into more of a Liberal Party campaign role rather than a PMO staff role. The Vancouver Sun story, which is the one we have in our show notes here, and read about this, talks a fair bit about what does mean. Is it going to be controversial at all? And probably isn't. The simple fact is basically nobody pays any attention to who the campaign staffers are unless they do something really bad. The fact that the Green Party brought on Warren Kinsella has everyone's... he has the occasional Twitter blow up, but you know, for the most part, that got like 1-2 days news coverage. A bunch of people got angry about it on Twitter, which, you know, that's what Twitter's for. And like, basically no one is going to be voting on that come October. So it's not really that big a deal in the long run. And like, it's the Liberal Party could maybe use some fresh blood in the sense that having some outside perspective would be good for them at this stage. But it's not bad politically in the sense that Butts is too toxic to have working on a campaign in a back room.
I don't think most voters... people are watching who's in and out of the campaign rooms, but the opposition parties are. And that's where this could be worse for the Liberals.
Yeah, but how much hate in an opposition?
The Conservatives are already apoplectic over this.
Yeah, they'll send out like a dozen fundraising emails and maybe get like a few people chip in $20 on it. And yeah, good for them. But they'll send out a fundraising email on anything. So, but nobody's going to pick up on it outside of that like tight circle who already hate everything Trudeau does anyway. So,
The question to watch longer term into the election is whether this brings back that Liberal corruption cronyism narrative that was starting to make a lot of traction during the height of the SNC scandals, which has seemingly quieted down in the last 2 months. And the Liberals' risk here, by not just saying, no, he's not involved, whether or not he is letting that come back. Like, Butts himself doesn't matter, but it's the perception and that damage to the brand.
Maybe, but once again, like, I don't think outside of the people in this room, like, people have spent a lot of time really focusing on it or notice about it. Like, my prediction is, in like a couple of weeks, there will be no more stories mentioning Jerry Butts and his connection to SNC-Lavalin and all that stuff. It'll just fade into the background as everyone gets worked up about, I don't know, chocolate milk or something.
Food guide again. It was in the news more this week. We're not talking about it.
Well, moving from the back rooms of Ottawa to the courtrooms of Alberta, the Turn Off the Taps court case has hit another roadblock, this being BC's challenge against Alberta's unenacted law, or law that exists on the book but they aren't using, that allows them to shut off all oil and gas to BC. So in this case, Alberta Judge RJ Hall released a decision earlier this week that basically said, yeah, we can't actually really look at this case because you don't have standing here.
Yeah, BC applied to the Superior Court in Alberta, the Court of Queen's Bench, and to the federal court in a subsequent challenge. The Alberta court has said the federal court exists for exactly this purpose to adjudicate
disputes between provinces.
Yeah. And we here in the Alberta Court of Queen's Bench exist to deal with shit that's in our province. Go away. Which seems like the right answer. I think everyone was kind of looking for a more substantive decision, but this is ultimately just a
I mean, I go elsewhere. Yeah, I kind of get it, though. Like, if you were a judge on an Alberta trial, like, why weigh in on this, on a very, on a complicated judicial question, like, or a complicated constitutional question like that, when it's really not your jurisdiction? So it makes perfect sense that they'd follow that procedure and boot it out.
Yeah. Judges, it seems, will often take the easiest way out of most decisions because...
Or to be legally a little less, maybe snarky isn't the right word, but glib about it. Yeah, courts usually try and rule as narrowly as possible for good reason. You don't want to, like, paint as broad a brush and, like, have unintended precedent be set. So in this case, they rule very narrowly that, yeah, this isn't the place to actually discuss these things. Go bud the federal court.
The other good news for Trans Mountain pipeline enthusiasts is the national... They exist.
I know.
They're in the premiership in Alberta. The National Energy Board has said there's no need to actually go back through all the permits that have already been issued. Construction can go ahead based on what much of the work that's already been done. It was something like 73% of the pipeline's route had already been approved by the NEB, so work can get started. Shovels can go in grounds. That hasn't, of course, stopped EcoJustice and a bunch of other groups from filing subsequent lawsuits alleging, again, that the further consultations were still not sufficient and still didn't manage to allay the concerns of the last time the Federal Court of Appeal struck down this approval. But that was always kind of expected.
Yeah. But still good news for the Trans Mountain project. A project that might soon have new owners, as an Indigenous-led consortium has put in an unsolicited bid to buy the Trans Mountain pipeline. This is Project Reconciliation, and they've previously announced their intention to bid on the pipeline, and this week they actually went ahead and submitted it. At a previous point, they'd said they were going to submit a $6.9 billion offer, but we don't actually know if that's what is in their submission, which, yeah, would actually mean the government made a small profit on it.
A profit they would use 100% on green projects, as they've promised. This is almost a bit weird. Like, they were clear that they were going to bid. No, I don't question that. The timing is a little weird. I understand trying to be first, but if it's not officially open yet and you're just trying to get in there, and it still feels a bit unclear that it's going through.
So my thoughts on the timing here is that they seem to be basically structuring this to be as perfect a PR thing as possible. In the name... focuses on the Indigenous-led stuff, and putting it in just a couple months before the election. Like, if you think the government doesn't want to have to deal with the Trans Mountain issue and wants to get it off of its books, let them say, hey, we've made some money on it, you know, we rescued this thing, but we're not actually ourselves building a pipeline for you. But, you know, Alberta, you're getting your pipeline, but, you know, everyone else, we're not building a pipeline with government money. Like, being able to do that in August or September looks really good for the government on this just before an election. So my read on this is that this group is trying to basically come in and say, hey, we'll take this off your hands. You get a PR win out of it. Sell us the pipeline.
That just means they take on some huge risks that if you wait, go away. Or you don't have to worry about, because owning it means you take on all the liability that the government has handily taken over. So I see the advantage for the Trudeau to sell right now. We'll see if the bid was strong enough or if negotiations go through. It would take that issue mostly out of the election, which would be nice, so we don't have to keep talking about a pipeline.
Or a pipeline the government owns we will no longer be talking about, because I will bet a large amount of money that there will still be talk about the pipeline in October, November, the summer of 2021. This is not an issue that's going away anytime soon.
Speaking of issues that are never going away, fighter jet replacements are in the news again as the request for proposals for the replacements to the CF-18s has finally opened. And Saab, Airbus, Boeing, and Lockheed Martin have been invited to submit bids. They'll have until spring of 2020 to submit their bids. The winner will be chosen probably by 2022, which means we might get the airplanes in 2025, a full 15 years after the Conservatives started the replacement program.
Yeah, so I was mentioning this before I recorded. As a teenager, when I was looking to join the force, I was thinking of being a fighter pilot. Can't do it because red, green, colorblind. But I was looking at, oh, what's...
It must have been really sad to miss out on that bit of Canadiana television back in the day.
I actually ended up watching a lot of red, green as a kid. Good show.
Hey, we can keep those CF-18s flying with a bit of duct tape.
But yeah, the plan back then was there were going to be a replacement fighter, probably an F-35, by 2017, which astute listeners will note was 2 years ago, and we are just now getting around to asking people to submit bids on it. So this has not been a well-handled file or one that's moved particularly quickly.
Yeah, the CF-18s came into service a full 6 years before I was born, which is reassuring.
Yeah, they're older than most of the pilots.
The thing I was saying before was I can understand a government that comes in on a, let's just get rid of a fighter fleet. Let's, as a country, decide our military will not involve interceptor fighter aircrafts anymore. We'll focus our energies elsewhere. You can make that argument. It can be consistent. A lot of, you'll disagree with it, Scott. A lot of people will disagree with it, but it's consistent. There's a way to make it. I can also see the, we need new fighters because these are old and falling apart. That's a consistent argument. The, yes, we need new fighters, but we don't want those fighters because those guys like them and we should have different fighters is dumb and terrible and has left us in this shitty situation.
It's not even the first time that's happened, too.
This is consistent with everything we try to buy.
Yeah, the Seeking replacement had a whole snafu with that, trying to... The newly elected Chechen government canceling the contract to replace them, and then we're finally actually taking delivery of them in the late 2010s. So yeah, there's a long and storied history of bad procurement in this country. So yeah, we may have an idea in a couple years who will be successful at this, because even that evaluating the bids takes a long time for this government, for government in general. If I was to make a guess at taking the politics out of it, which is pretty much impossible on this file, it's probably going to be an F-35. It's by far the most logical choice, assuming the price tag isn't way higher than the other ones. Like it's the fighter to buy. That doesn't mean we'll actually buy it, because this is a mess of a political file.
And it does not mean we'll get it by 2025. Maybe 2030.
If we're lucky.
Maybe we can get electric fighter jets, because we need to get off gas and fossil fuels.
Yeah, the fighter jets will probably be one of the last things to decarbonize, you know, when we invent arc reactors. Well, moving from one perpetual sorry state of affairs in the Canadian government to another, 24 Sussex is in the news. It looks like the needed repairs on the barely standing up official residence of the Prime Minister, which the Prime Minister is not living in because it's in such bad shape, become a bit of a source of controversy as the Tories are slamming the nearly $100 million price tag, which in reality is closer to $83 million, and that covers every official residence in Ottawa that needs to be repaired.
But Scheer, don't worry, has, quote, innovative ways to fix up 24 Sussex that will somehow shave a bunch of money off. You know, cut corners on your renovations? I don't know.
Well, I think if they get, like, a smart home thing, they'll, like, get a branding deal with Amazon or something. Like the Alets.
It'll be like the Smart City Toronto thing, but...
Sidewalk
Labs. But this will for be our Prime Minister's residence, that's...
Sidewalk Govissa, I guess.
So, 24 Sussex has been apparently never properly renovated in, like, 70 years.
Yeah, so it only became the official residence, I think, the 50s, 60s. And yeah, it's basically had no work done on it ever since then, because prime ministers don't like to take the heat of actually having work done. And you know, unless we think this is a purely Canadian thing, the White House nearly fell down before, I think it was Roosevelt, ended up gutting the thing and completely redoing it, like down to the I-beam sort of gutting.
Well, and the BC government is notoriously behind on repairing the legislature.
And bring up to seismic code, too.
That's a big thing.
Yeah. we have an earthquake, losing the entire government because they couldn't be bothered to spend money to make sure their building wouldn't fall down isn't great.
Well, and all our friends in the press gallery.
Yes.
Like, it's one thing for MLAs to risk their own lives by not voting to fix it up, but there's a lot of staffers and people who don't have a choice but to work in that unsafe building. So fix it up for the journalists and the other people who have to go in there. The same thing applies to 24 Sussex. It's, we don't have many heritage buildings in Canada that represent this as a country. Let's keep the one. Although there is a suggestion that it would actually be cheaper and easier to just tear down 24 Sussex and rebuild a new prime ministerial residence.
That's not without its merits. I mean, we could even get the architect who's doing the Chateau Laurier extension.
That'll start a new controversy in Ottawa.
I mean, this is like the one thing that everybody in Canada seems to really care about except me. I just have no opinion on it.
Yeah. That's just because all of the journalists who cover Parliament Hill walk by it and therefore have strong opinions on it. And so it's not that everyone cares. It's just that everyone who writes opinions cares. But for 24 Sussex, and I guess Stornoway, the residence of the leader of the official opposition, is also in need of renovations.
I think the speaker's residence, too.
I think Rideau Hall might be okay, but that might be the only one.
Yeah, because we're generally okay spending money on the Governor General.
Got to keep that monarchy happy.
Maybe not a lot of money, but like enough that they can probably do basic repairs.
It's just one of those items that the government needs to spend on, and you need to take it out of the politicians' hands, because it's not about them spending it on themselves. It's about them spending it on the institutions of this country. At least they're spending on the House of Commons and Parliament itself.
Yeah, if you have to, just make a big deal about bringing it up to like be a net zero building or something. But like we're a G7 country, like we should be able to build an official residence and keep it from falling down. It shouldn't be hard, but we make it hard.
Counterpoint, the UK House of Parliament is almost falling into the Thames, only they've only just recently agreed to.
I'm guessing pretty much for the same reason, not wanting to spend the money.
Yeah, but they are moving and renovating and bringing it up. But they have to do something like relocate their House of Commons and House of Lords for a few years.
No, same thing we're doing, so.
They don't know where they can fit them, though.
Well,
there was talk of going to Manchester for a while or something.
Why?
That's what anyone who goes to Manchester asks, other than the Tech Museum. Anyway, government, fix up our Prime Minister's house so whoever wins the next election can actually live in it. Maybe Elizabeth May will be Prime Minister and she can make it a green roof with solar panels and stuff. And finally, thank you to every one of our listeners who filled out the Daylight Savings Time consultation.
All 223,000 of you.
Your efforts set a provincial record for consultation responses, more than doubling the number of people who responded to the electoral reform referendum consultation, and blowing out of water the 40,000 people who responded to the cannabis regulation consultations. It's a lot of people have opinions on daylight savings times. We don't know what those say yet. John Horgan was quoted as saying, "I haven't seen the breakout of whether people are pro or con, but people responding usually responding because they are passionate about something." And he says, "I have not met many people on the street who are saying, I want to change my clock back in the fall and spring forward. Nobody." And he is committed to making a decision in the right time.
No word on that, if the right time will be in or out of daylight savings.
No, it totally depends on the three states to the south of us and the approval, I think, of Congress.
Well, it doesn't entirely depend on it, but we could go our own way. So the responses are going to be summarized and sent out in a report, I believe, within the next few weeks, and I'm sure we'll be talking about it when that comes out. And that has been Politihost. Find everything we talked about at politihost.ca. If you're a first-time listener, make sure to subscribe and let us know what you think. Support the show and get access to our exclusive Slack channel at patreon.com/politihost. If you have ideas for the show, feel free to send them to us. And join us for our live show on August 8th. Tickets are at Eventbrite at politihost150.eventbrite.com. There'll be a link in the show notes. Our intro music credit is Beautiful British Columbia. That's Rishna Plotnikoff. Thanks for listening.